Chapter 1. Struggle or Submit. The wolf eats only the lamb he finds all alone. As I write this, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, is searching former President Donald Trump's private residence. Is this being done because the U.S. deep state, the shadow government, the military-industrial complex, whatever you want to call them, fear the rise in the awareness and resistance of the people? Do you think that the power elite has controlled the U.S. for decades, with democracy hollowed out and maintained as a useful front, a game show in which the people have been played by those who believe that they know best? As I will show, some U.S. presidents have suggested that this is exactly what has happened, that political representatives are just the visible agents, the fronts, for the real power merchants peddling visions of impossible nirvanas as they make gazillions. I believe that the agenda setters are aware of the public's growing suspicion, and they recognize the threat this represents to their continued dominance, hence the disjointed narratives they are pumping out and the unraveling of the West. The story of civilizations is one of growth and collapse, and one must ask, why should the relatively recent flowering of representative democracy be any different? Ruling dynasties and elites are the dominant feature of societies and the key to the waxing and waning of nations and empires as they age, declining from vigor to Viagra, losing their vision as leaders soften before the inevitable fall. This is what is now happening with our elite-led representative system, particularly in the U.S., with a feeble-minded old codger and his handlers not only losing touch with the people, but fearing them. Desperate and visible FBI agent-inspired agent provocateur plots are more signs pointing the way to systemic collapse. These are ominous indications of the loss of integrity of those in the justice apparatus and reveal the depth of the internal collapse of the formerly unquestioned leading democratic power on the planet. The FBI has been up to shenanigans for generations, with a burglary second story group operating as far back as FDR's time, but at least it was generally used to counter external communist threats, not to set up Americans, a little short of the grey matter. Mankiewicz, 1973, Pisa 16. Many decades ago, an experienced soldier and historian wrote of these cycles, estimating the average length of a civilization to be in the region of 250 years. Glubb, 2002, pp. 8, 10. Interestingly, from the U.S. Declaration of Independence in 1776 to 2023 brings us very close to that mark. I believe that the FBI's banana republic antics mark a fitting end to the U.S. as we know it, so in this case, Glubb Pasha's forecasting tool appears to be almost bang on. From the era of the genius of Ben Franklin, scientist, politician, and businessman, to the stench of decay under the shaking hands with nobody, Biden lies the 10-generation lifespan that John Glubb suggested as the measure. Democracies thus appear unable to escape this cycle because they too are reliant on a leadership group that declines like any other. The study of elites became a feature in political studies as they have been central to civilizations throughout history. But what if the elites were not in total control? Would this cycle of rise and fall change? Would democracy escape the fate of all previous civilizations if the capable in the elite were allowed some space to enjoy their talents, but not given the free rein they have enjoyed up to now, to conspire against and manipulate the rest? Is it the corruption of the elite that leads to our decline? Is there a solution, a way to stop such a collapse? Would corruption be reduced if the people had proper oversight, with the elite having their wings clipped and their ability to control politics stripped from them? If corruption is reduced and competition increased, would the life of a democracy be extended? Can we avoid the descent into a new totalitarianism or a new centuries-long dark age? Fortunately, I believe that there is a peaceful path out of this mess, and it has proven itself as not only viable, but enviable. If absolute power corrupts absolutely, then the solution to political corruption in our crude little representative system is self-evident. Dilute the power by ensuring that all voters have some of it. This division of the power of the state so that each citizen has their share of responsibility spreads the load whilst minimizing vulnerable nodes, naturally minimizing opportunities to corrupt individuals while increasing voter commitment. This is what the hybrid system does, all the while retaining a representative element to ensure care and consideration are given by community-minded politicians in the drafting of our laws. This is why it works in practice in Switzerland. This is real politics, not the theory of real politic. For those on the far left, I wish to remind you that every single communist regime killed its own, and the major regimes saw off, or continue to see off, huge numbers of their unlucky citizens. So, communism, Marx's murderous version of it, failed miserably, and no other experiments are required. For those on the far right, my granddad and his generation did for fascism, so we can ignore the overblown rhetoric orchestrated by the left and those benefiting from division regarding that largely extinct lot as well. Now, for those in the middle, democracy is not too healthy, but it's not on life support in all its forms. It can be saved, but only by us. We the people are the solution, our own saviors, not the lofty utopians, not the self-obsessed money grubbers, not the lefty academics and lawyers, and most certainly not the shoddy goods spinmeisters in the political class. Civilizations collapse because the elite rot first, not the subjugated heads down working people. So the solution is for the people to rule, for a real democracy in which we set the agenda, relying upon our broader experience and the wisdom of our crowd. The capability of tiny, narrow-minded cliques of self-interested political narcissists pales in comparison with that of the entire voting population. However, the reason the political class continues to prosper is because they are more easily manipulated by their paymaster overseers. The hybrid solution covered in the chapters that follow Trump's whatever these clowns can suggest, from left or right, relying on our willpower and the good sense of the people, allowing us, should enough of us wish to veto any proposals spawned by the paid-for-machine politicians and their parties. For some decades now, we have been trialing extreme individualism, with the community disappearing in the mirror. But this seems to have descended about as far as it can before disintegrating. This is when the hybrid system shows its strengths and triumphs, with the majority taking control, putting solutions together to clear up the mess. These answers to our problems are democratically arrived at and easier to accept than those foisted on us by a party. I am not alone in desiring this, as a 2017 Pew Research survey found that 2/3 of people around the world were in favor of citizens voting directly on major national issues. Matsusaka, 2020, p. 61. The experiment has been running since 1848, and this repeatable test has provided better results than any other existing political system, be they democratic, utopian, or totalitarian, the latter two being much the same thing, as the eugenicists get to scratch their itch in both of them. As this representative direct hybrid demonstrates, two supporting systems are better than one, so this should keep the diversity tick boxes happy too. Pure representative democracy, communism, fascism, and authoritarian theocracies have had their day. And it's time for the people to bask in some sunshine and for the old order to sit in the shade. Since we first began living in groups large enough to allow one man, one family, or one clique to dominate the mass, the choice has been to struggle or to submit. In most cases, the people eventually lost out to the power hungry and these strong-arm merchants were able to extend their dominion over ever-increasing numbers, usually through violence or the threat of it. This fact is made clear by the definition of the state, that it is the sole organization with the right to settle disputes using force and to make and enforce laws allowing it to do so. Fortunately, the sacrifices of our predecessors have carried us within striking distance of ending this tyranny imposed on the many by the few with special access to power. In our hunter-gatherer past, a few hardy souls could deal with a dominant bully who made life hell by banding together and agreeing on a way to rid themselves of the troublemaker. Maybe on the next hunting trip far from their camp, they would see him off with a few spears hurled into his back. This no doubt went on for many thousands of years before the super-violent and fast-talking proto-politicians were able to take over. Politics probably grew out of such events as groups expanded to such a size that a few downtrodden hunters were no longer sufficient to take on the domineering tribal leaders and their henchmen. Today we call them kleptocrats, presidents, and bureaucrats, and a few other choice words, but only in a very select band of countries will you find elites still brought to heel, their power effectively limited by the people. For most of us, such tribal control mechanisms are aged myths, and now we live in systems engineered by tiny elites to ensure their unending dominance. This has not been without its benefits, as civilization is better off without murderous solutions, and we can now rely on less bloody forms of resolution, either in the courts of public opinion or the legal system. However, this progress has been bought at a price, with our continued subjugation camouflaged behind a wall of abused words, fake history, and false narratives. As none of us is perfect, the civilizations constructed by imperfect ruling castes on the backs of the rest of us are faulty too. That's just how things have been. Today we see representatives and their parties moving ever further away from their idealist foundations, losing their vocational drive and the close links they once had with huge numbers of party members. We watch with disgust as the party hacks fashion policies to suit those they fawn over and schmooze with, especially the canny emperors of the finance giants, the foundation trustees, and the presidents forevermore of totalitarian regimes. However, just ask yourself, who voted for them and their policies? I was born in 1960 and grew up when representative democracy seemed to work. In fact, as Eisenhower warned us, that wasn't the case. The rot had already set in. However, my generation had something urgent to distract us and to focus our fears upon. The Soviet Union was a powerful opponent which was worse than us, as the state-induced famines and Gulag Archipelago proved. The old bomber general, Curtis LeMay, was the planner of the Tokyo firebombing raid, which killed over 100,000 people, and in 1962 he was incensed by President Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He insulted the president to his face, comparing Kennedy's decision not to bomb the island's rocket sites as almost as bad as the appeasement at Munich, Douglas, 2010. In their defense, such U.S. warhawks had seen total war, and their minds were bent by that. Not only did we have the communists to watch out for, we had little in the way of alternative media, as the big corporations and our governments had much greater control over what we could learn through a few TV stations and interest-controlled press outlets. I did not understand how truly misleading the words representative democracy were until I was in my 20s. Eventually, I came to see that these words were carefully crafted to cover the reality of the retention of control, using this term as camouflage, offering a concept many of us were prepared to die for. In the end, though, these words have a grain of truth, as they are not quite as misleading as the Democratic People's Republic, which the Korea ruled over by Rocketman, claims itself to be. We have representatives, but where do their interests and loyalties lie? Korea first, Paymaster Party second, us last. The wishes of the party whips almost always seem to receive closer attention than those of constituents. Check the voting records of the most ambitious rising stars. Our votes in the 4 or 5 year rounds of elections have very little effect on many of them, but they play along for form's sake. Look at the re-election chances of incumbents in the US, opensecrets.org, 2022, or the safe seat constituencies of MPs in the UK, Garland, 2019. Why would they be more concerned about our wishes than those of the party employing them? It is only where political power brokers are controlled by the people's veto, the routine use of the referendum at the national level, that you find real democracy with the electorate listened to and in charge. Sadly, this is limited to just 3 countries, Switzerland, Taiwan, and Estonia. Taiwan only effectively joined the referendum group in the late 1990s when they bravely booted out their military government, and Estonia only in 2016 when they introduced their new digital direct democracy voting platform. The rest of us are living a lie, existing in democracy as it is sold to us, but not as it should be. In fact, it's just more fake news. However, the hybrid is not fake, and this book aims to open your eyes to this fact and to get you off the couch to help rid us of the pure representative systemic sham for good. After a lifetime of battling for democracy and contrasting and comparing the options available, I have come to the practical conclusion that the extensively tested Swiss solution is the best example of what most of us might consider to be a proper democracy. Sadly, the Swiss system has not seen many offspring since its inception in 1848, but this is largely due to the suppression and active dismissal of the idea by national and global interests who ensure through their funding and favors that they benefit most from the current system by pocketing control of our political parties. However, the internet, along with unbelievably greedy behavior and the evident failure of our current system, has at last led to a greater awareness of our system's faults, and the mendacity of our rulers has become more obvious by the day. We must make use of this new understanding to educate and inspire others to adopt the hybrid. As has proven to be the case in the past, the essential pillar on which our hybrid system must be built is the greatest tool of direct democracy, the referendum. I also refer to it as the people's veto, the people's safeguard, and Dicey's decider. This will ensure that all laws issued by the representatives in the legislature can be subject to our veto. This idea was first introduced in the UK Parliament in 1896 by the Liberal MP Robert Wallace. In Switzerland, few new laws excite enough interest to see this option being exercised, so government is not encumbered with endless referendums. However, where the people do want their say, they can demand it and have it. Any representative system that adopted this single measure would improve the nation immeasurably, ending nearly all the turmoil we see in our supposed democracies. That's a fact. It's historically and empirically proven, and this book will use examples to convince and motivate you to demand its adoption by your nation, whatever system you live under today. This book is designed as a primer and a hands-on manual, aiming to inspire you to become a part of the great democratic reformation, adapting our failing representative democracies to become democratically effective hybrids. The people's veto lies at the heart of the hybrid and is an existential threat to crooked billionaires in the financial and commercial complexes seeking unfair advantages from our governments, and a direct challenge to the killer clique in the CCP under its dictator for life. To make full use of it, I suggest that you mark up sections you will want to revisit, circle particular words or phrases that resonate, and fold back the top corner of pages to make it easier to find parts you think are important. This book is intended, first and foremost, as a manual for use, not a one-off information download that is little remembered or referred to. The more a book is marked, scored, and abused, the greater the effect it has had, a compliment to the author and his message. I hope that you make a right mess of it. The chapters that follow contain lessons learned in a life aimed at guaranteeing freedom, a desire shaped in short conversations with my grandfather, a man who saw his best friend get his head blown off in a battle somewhere in Europe. I grew up admiring the men around me who had risked all to defeat Hitler and other dictators, but over the years, I began to question many of the assumptions I had grown up with, particularly who benefited from their sacrifices. In my early years, I found it easy to justify my acceptance of the standard narrative on the grounds that we were confronting communism and terrorism, and that many of the conspiracy theorists seemed a bit dotty, talking about lizards and the like. But that changed. Over recent decades, the dots began to form a pattern, and I read more widely, and the picture firmed up. When I had worked my way through War is a Racket by Smedley Butler, a U.S. Marine Corps general who had twice won his country's highest gallantry award, the Medal of Honor, few illusions were left. The title of his short book tells you pretty much all you need to know, but I can recommend you plow through it. To keep this Get the Job Done manual to a manageable size, I don't intend to cover every issue that I raise in detail. However, I do want to detonate something in your thinking that throws you off track and disconcerts you enough to dig deeper and to check out what I say, satisfying yourself as to my information, my sources, and their credibility. For instance, you can Google Smedley Butler right now and begin the journey. Whatever you do, never accept what you hear from any new source, and I do mean any, until you have checked it out in some detail from various angles. Just doing this will demonstrate the benefit of thinking for yourself. As they say, trust but verify. When I read the old U.S. Marines book, I had finished my time in the Army and had some success in my corporate business career, but my own experiences and studies finally piled high enough to flood over the barriers holding back views and news that contradicted the conventional view of the world manufactured by those controlling our media, our schools, and our culture. Finally, I realized how completely the system is rigged, with a few winners laughing all the way to the bank, which many of them own. They play by completely different rules, be they the few in the vanguard of a communist party or the network of favor-seeking funders of political parties in our shamocracies. Either way, they feast on our decency, innocence, and treasure with no compunction whatsoever, happy to expend our blood and iron across whole continents in their drive to control and milk us. What follows are my thoughts on how the majority can win the unending covert battle for power. Many don't realize that a ceaseless and deadly serious arm wrestle is underway, but they probably sense that things are spinning out of control and that there must be another way to reach that better place that our forebears sought for us. To accept that what I state is accurate, you will need to work through the book and then judge my claims about the depth of the problems we face and their genesis. At one time, I would not have taken seriously many of the assertions I make below, but the evidence is enough for a reasonable person, as the judges used to say, the man on the Clapham omnibus, to discern the truth of what follows. The justification and the tools to plan, execute, and secure that brighter future we hanker for are also offered up, so feel free to join me as I continue heading out that way to live free.